Well, thank you very much, Peter, for those very kind words of welcome. And could I start by thanking the Property Council for inviting me here to this lunch today? It's always a great pleasure to have opportunities like this to come back to Queensland. My talk today is really in two parts. The first part, I was going to talk about recent economic developments here and abroad. I was going to keep those pretty broad brush because the bank has put out a considerable amount of material over on the economy over the past few weeks. And then I was going to spend most of my time today talking about finance, because as you know, there's some concerns at present about the availability of finance, particularly in the property sector. So I think it's worth spending some time looking at what's going on there. So let me start by setting the scene with a few words on the economy. The global economy started to recover about a year ago from what was a very severe recession. That recovery is continuing, but the pace of growth differs significantly across various regions of the world. Asian growth has been, or had been, exceptionally strong in late 2009 and into earlier this year. And in response to that, central banks in the region, quite a number of them, have begun to tighten monetary policy. And you would have noticed that there's a fair bit of commentary at the moment about whether they're going to overdo it, whether there's going to be excessive slowing in these economies. And this is something we're watching very closely, but for the moment, our reading of the recent data out of Asia suggests that growth is returning to around a trend growth there, so that's a fairly good outcome. Asia is not the only region that's doing well at the moment. Latin America is also doing extremely well. However, as you know, growth in the US economy has been pretty lackluster. The US is continuing to grow, but momentum has clearly slowed. I think it was particularly slow over the sort of northern summer months. And I think recent data has probably been a little bit better than it was a few months back. But nonetheless, the risks in the US, I think, are still probably to the downside. Consumer confidence there is low. Housing and labour markets remain weak. And the repair of household balance sheets still has a long way to run. One bright spot in the US, however, is that business balance sheets are in very good shape and equipment investment is recovering. In Europe, there's a large disparity in growth across countries. Germany remains a clear front runner, benefiting from earlier economic reforms and Chinese demand for German capital goods. German unemployment, for example, has fallen to its lowest rate since the early 1990s. But other large countries in Europe, such as France and Italy, while they're growing, are probably still growing below trend. And some of the smaller countries, such as Greece and Ireland, are still experiencing very severe recessions. Overall, the recent data have been consistent with around trend growth in the global economy. At the bank, Reserve Bank, where forecasting that growth will continue at around this pace over the next year or so. And that view is broadly similar to that of other forecasters such as the International Monetary Fund and other world bodies. From Australia's perspective, this would represent a favourable outcome, resulting in commodity prices remaining at relatively high levels compared with earlier decades, even if, as we forecast, they decline somewhat from their current elevated levels. In the Australian economy, growth currently is around trend and underlying inflation is in the target range. This is a comfortable position to be in, but the challenge is to keep the economy there over the next few years, and this challenge is not going to be easy. First, the economy has been growing continuously for almost 20 years, having experienced only relatively mild downturns during that period, and is therefore approaching full capacity. Second, The resources boom that began around 2005, and which abated for a time during the global financial crisis, is re-emerging, and this is adding to pressure on capacity. Over the next couple of years, we expect that economic growth in Australia will pick up from its current rate to around 3.25%. From its current rate of around 3.25% to closer to 4%. Domestic spending is expected to drive this pickup. Over the past year, for example, final demand in the country grew by about 5%, and this was partly due to government spending. This government spending is in the process of being scaled back at present, but indications are that private spending will pick up noticeably in the period ahead. This is especially the case for business investment. Income growth will also add to spending capacity. Over the past year, reflecting the rise in the terms of trade, nominal income in Australia rose by 10%. If, as we expect, growth in Australia increases to an above-trend pace, it's likely that in due course underlying inflation will pick up from its current rate of about 2.75%. We're currently forecasting for inflation to rise to around 3% by the first half of 2012. As you know, earlier this year, the Reserve Bank Board returned official interest rates to a level that was consistent with lending interest rates being close to their average levels. Having done so, we've been comfortable to leave official interest rates unchanged in recent months. However, as noted in the statement issued after the board meeting earlier this week, if economic conditions evolve as currently expected, it will be likely that higher interest rates will be required at some point to ensure that inflation remains consistent with the medium-term target. Let me now move to financing. Now, since the global financial crisis, the availability of credit has tightened significantly around the globe. The rate of growth of credit in most advanced economies at present is close to zero or even negative. Australia has not been immune from these developments, though credit growth here has held up better than most other advanced economies. Now, we shouldn't be surprised that credit has slowed, as this is typically what happens after a financial crisis. In the boom years that preceded crisis, credit expands very strongly as businesses or households, or sometimes both, gear up either to fund spending or to acquire assets. Some of the decisions that people make during those periods are based on unrealistic expectations about future economic conditions or asset markets, and as such, they turn out not to be financially viable. So what happens then is that a process of deleveraging begins. Businesses and households become more cautious, increasing saving, selling assets and reducing debt. Lenders also become more cautious, both because they see the weaker economic circumstances as increasing the risk on loans, particularly because through those periods the value of collateral tends to decline, and also because lenders start to begin to experience a noticeable rise in bad debts. The result is that both the demand for and the supply of credit tend to decline. Now, the authorities typically take steps to counter these forces, starting by tightening economic policies through the upswing and then easing them during the downswing. Now, sometimes, as has happened in this cycle, they also provide direct fiscal assistance to lenders to help them sustain the supply of credit. However, it would be unrealistic to expect that these measures can entirely smooth out the credit cycle, just as it would be unrealistic to expect that the authorities can eliminate the cycle in equity markets. These cycles are inherent in human behaviour. History shows that it takes time for households, businesses and lenders to regain confidence after a financial crisis, and there are limits on the extent to which economic policy measures can accelerate that process. This is a very important issue in many developed economies at present. Here in Australia, the credit cycle was mild compared with overseas experience, but nonetheless, there was a cycle. Credit, particularly to businesses, increased relatively quickly for a number of years, and now the downside of that cycle is currently being played out. In the period since the mid-1980s, there have been three broad expansion phases in credit in Australia. Two of these have been related to business credit and one to household credit. The first of these cycles began in the mid-1980s when financial deregulation led to a strong expansion in credit to businesses. The annual growth of business credit exceeded 30% for a time. The subsequent economic downturn saw many business failures, large losses by banks, and a prolonged period of deleveraging by businesses. In that episode, it took almost 4 years for credit growth to return to a relatively normal rate. The next phase of credit growth was driven by the household sector. This began in the mid-1990s. Up until then, Australian households had relatively little debt by international standards. Household debt outstanding was around 50% of household disposable income. The fall in interest rates in the early 1990s, the switch in financial innovation from products directed to businesses to those directed to households, and the general prosperity that followed all contributed to households substantially increasing their debt over the subsequent 10 to 15 years. And currently, household debt's about 1.5 times income, which is a ratio that's broadly in line with debt ratios in other advanced economies. As you know, most of this increase in debt by households was for the purchase of housing, and so it was mirrored in a rise in house prices. Since 2005, the pace of growth of household credit has slowed, and on average, it's been broadly equal to the rate of growth of household income. As the Reserve Bank has noted before, this is a reassuring development, since continued rises or increases in the gearing of the household sector would eventually have exposed the sector to substantial risk. Household credit continues to be moderate. Over the past year or so, for example, household credit has increased by about 7%. Most of this has been due to housing loans and other forms of household debt, such as credit card debt, margin loans, and personal loans, have been relatively flat. All this is consistent with households taking a more cautious approach to their finances, as evidenced also by the increase in the household saving ratio relative to that was experienced in the early part or the middle part of the past decade. So for households, the current picture is one where borrowing for housing is growing broadly in line with income, house prices are pretty stable, and there's little appetite for other forms of debt. And from the Reserve Bank's perspective, this seems to be a pretty satisfactory state of affairs. The third episode I want to talk about is a pickup in business credit that began in 2005. This cycle was not as pronounced as that in the cycle in business credit in the late 1980s, but nonetheless, for a time, business credit grew by about 20% a year. Now, part of this debt was to fund investment, which, as you know, has been very strong, but a significant part also went for financial activity. There was a general increase in the gearing of the corporate sector as boards worried that they could be seen as having lazy balance sheets which would make them vulnerable to takeover by private equity. Over the 4 years to 2008, the gearing ratio of the corporate sector rose from around 60% to around 80%. The global financial crisis brought a change in thinking by both businesses and their lenders. And there's been a sharp slowing in business credit since then. Over the past year, business credit has fallen by about 4%. However, this has not translated to a sharp weakening in economic activity, as was the case in the early 1990s, because a shift is taking place in the way businesses fund themselves. Helped by the pool of funds that has been built up through the superannuation system, businesses were able to raise a substantial amount of equity when debt markets dried up through the financial crisis. Most importantly, however, internally generated funds from profits have been very strong. As such, the total availability of funds to businesses has continued to increase at around its long-run average rate, and this is even though credit growth has been soft. These shifting funding patterns mean that credit by itself may not be giving an accurate picture of the overall availability of funds to businesses. The trends that we've observed recently are not evenly spread through the business sector. The mining sector has made heavy use of internal funds, while the property and infrastructure sectors have relied much more on debt. And I'll say more about these issues, particularly in relation to property, in a few minutes. While the business sector is also often the focus when people worry about the availability of credit, the recent cycle in credit to small business has not been as severe as that in the cycle of large business credit. Growth in credit to small businesses through the boom period was much more restrained than the run-up in large business credit. And credit outstanding to small businesses has held up much better since. Over the past 6 months or so, credit to small business has grown at an annual rate of about 8%. So given the interest of this group in particular, let me now move more specifically to property financing. Property-related lending accounts for a very significant share of total business lending by banks and other lenders. It also tends to be among the most cyclical components of lending, rising strongly through the boom periods and then contracting sharply. And it's also a component of lending on which defaults can rise very quickly. At the Reserve Bank, we monitor lending to the property sector very closely, not only because it's very important for the economy, but also because of its impact or potential risk to financial stability. Lending to commercial property began to pick up noticeably from around 2004 onwards. And at its peak, just before the global financial crisis, it was growing by about 27% a year. Now, the foreign-owned banks in particular were the lenders that were growing their lending the fastest through that period. With lending to commercial property growing significantly faster than other business lending, the share of business loans that were going to property increased from about a quarter to a third. For the regional banks and the foreign banks, the ratio was considerably higher, in some cases close to half. Now, given this rise in this proportion of lending going to property, it's perhaps not surprising that many banks now feel they're overweight that sector and are reluctant to make new loans, and some, as you know, are looking to cut back. Since the peak in early 2009, commercial property lending has decreased by about 10%. Foreign banks have led this contraction, reducing their lending by a cumulative 35% since then. Loan limits have fallen more than outstandings, so the usage of lending facilities has increased to about 90%. At the same time, funding through non-bank sources has also tightened. Commercial mortgage-backed securities, which at the peak in 2007 were accounting for about 5% of total commercial property financing, it's contracted by about two-thirds since then. This contraction has been accentuated by the decline in mortgage trusts and some other funds that were entities that were substantial investors in these sorts of securities. Adding to the cyclicality in commercial property lending is the fact that these loans tend to be among the most risky of bank loans. That was the case in the early 1990s, and unfortunately it's the case again now. The proportion of commercial property loans that are impaired has risen sharply since 2007, from less than 0.5% to around 6%. This is much higher than the impairment rate for business loans in general, which where the rate is around 3%. The impairment rate on property loans has risen particularly for loans in the retail and residential segments of the market. The banks that expanded their balance sheets the fastest through the boom years have been the ones that have now experienced the sharpest increase in impairment of loans. Foreign-owned banks, for example, currently have about 15% of their commercial property loans in arrears. That's compared with about 4% for the major banks. The property sector, as you know, is vulnerable to changes in the availability of credit because it operates with relatively high levels of gearing and low levels of cash. Gearing of the listed property companies has risen substantially over the past decade. It used to be the case that the sector had significantly less gearing than the corporate sector in general, but the run-up in debt and the fall in asset values that subsequently happened resulted in gearing of the property sector reaching a peak of over 100% in 2008, which is well above the corporate sector average. Similarly, cash holdings of corporations in the real estate sector are low compared with other corporates. Through the boom years, the cash holdings of the listed real estate companies fell to less than 10%. Less than 2% of assets, compared with 6 to 8% elsewhere in the corporate sector. So in short, it's difficult not to conclude that financing of the property sector became overextended through the boom years and that a period of adjustment is now largely unavoidable. In saying this, I don't want to downplay the difficulties that some firms are now experiencing as that adjustment takes place. I also don't want to downplay the impact this is having on the property development for the economy. The Reserve Bank is very much aware of both these issues. But cycles like the one we're going through seem to be endemic to the property sector, which I think raises the question of whether over the longer term the financing model of the sector needs to shift towards more equity and less debt. So that's in some ways been a fairly gloomy assessment of what's going on at the moment with property. So let me try to redress that by ending on a more positive note. And the observation I want to make is that the adjustment process has already been running for a substantial period, and a lot of progress has been made. The equity raisings that have taken place have already reduced gearing levels substantially. And I think there's some signs that the run-up in arrears on property loans is coming to an end. More generally, as the economy improves over the next couple of years, I think that will be reflected in the commercial property market also. And I think there's already some signs that that is happening. So as that happens, I think it would boost lenders' willingness to start making loans to the sector again. But I don't think it would be in anybody's interest to return to the free-flowing credit of a few years ago. I'll end there and thank you very much for your attention.
Rick, thanks very much. Please take a seat. I'd like to get out of the spotlight there, into the hot seat. Sit back, relax, this won't hurt a bit. One of the criticisms that's made of reserve bankers, central bankers such as yourself, is about two-speed economies. And the Treasurer at the last Property Council lunch talked about Queensland having multiple speeds. In fact, I think he got up to 10. Stephen Hawking believes he can think in 23 dimensions, so we're probably still on the way. We've still got a few more there to go. But the criticism is this, and that is that monetary policy and interest rate settings in particular are a crude tool, that they might be one part right for one bit of the country, but they might bugger up the rest of it. What's your response to that?
Well, Glenn Stevens spoke about this just a couple of weeks ago, because it is a very important issue. I think the first observation I make is that people tend to overestimate the extent that there's a two-speed economy. It's the extent there's different speeds in the economy. As the Treasurer said, there can be many speeds. You know, at the moment, the states that are resource states are not doing all that well. Queensland, in some ways, is lagging other states, even though it's the centre of the resource industry. So there's a lot of things happening in the economy. The gap in performance between the various states is not unusually large. And so it's, you know, I think people do overstate the extent of those problems. But there's no doubt about it. You know, the average interest rate that suits the country does not suit every sector of the economy. That's just an issue that every country lives with. Here in Australia, I think it's less of a problem than some other countries. The United States has a much bigger dispersion across the states than we have, and even in Europe at the moment, you see the range in outcomes between some countries like Greece and Ireland and Germany. You know, clearly, the interest rate that suits one of those countries doesn't suit the other. So, it is an issue, but it's not an issue that's unique to us or unusually significant by historical standards.
You touched on housing in your talk. There's still a lot of chatter within Australia and internationally that Australia has a housing bubble.
Mm.
Does it?
My view on that is no. I think we went through a period where house prices have risen a lot, but the crucial thing between Australia and some other countries is that over that period when house prices have risen, we've also had a lot of income growth. And as I've mentioned in my talk, over the past year or so, income for the country rose 10%. Recently, the house prices are broadly rising in line with income, which is an okay outcome. There's some variation across different states. I think the states that had the boom through the first phase of the resource boom, you know, Queensland and Western Australia, house prices are softer than they are in New South Wales. In New South Wales, the boom really ended in 2003. And, we had a tough in New South Wales for 4 or 5 years, but it's reached a new equilibrium there now.
Mm. Well, it's hard to believe that there's a housing bubble when demand exceeds supply, which leads to the issue of affordability. The Reserve Bank started commenting on housing affordability that we noticed a few years back. What's your current position on the affordability of housing in Australia?
Well, house prices are where they are because the average person can afford them. It's determined by people's income. Now, the issue, I think when people talk about affordability, what they do mean is that some people can afford them more than others. And I think what's happened over the course of, we've had 20 years of very prosperous economic conditions here. And over that period, people of my generation have built up, have had a lot of income growth, find themselves in quite a comfortable financial position. And so you see, if you look at the composition of debt across the country, it is the higher income, older generation that are driving the gearing up. And in the course of doing that, they're crowding out the new entrants into the housing market. So I think that's the issue that that people are sort of worried about. Overall, by definition, house prices are where people can afford. If not, the price will come down.
Well, what if there are artificial constraints within the marketplace which are perverting our prices? Treasury used to have a purist view on housing, much the same as the one you've just articulated, but now these days they say in their reports quite often that there are artificial constraints. That is, land supply releases are not keeping up with demand, that there are the developer charges, as we heard from Wayne before, there's too much red tape, development delays. Do you think that they play any role in maybe perverting the supply-demand balance and thus prices?
Well, I think it does. These issues, I accept they're very significant issues that limit the increase in supply of housing. I've got a very open mind about whether that results in a significant change in the average level of house prices. Because, as I say, the average level of prices is really driven by incomes and what people can afford or want to put into housing. And the supply considerations really determine on how many people you have in each house. That's really what's happening. I mean, in recent times, with house prices being higher, I mean, what's happening is that the number of people per household, that is the number of people in each house, is increasing again, as people are finding ways to economise on housing.
But it's also kids coming back, which A, is not good for the sanity of their parents.
Yeah.
But B, it also means it delays them getting on that elevator where they're creating their own personal balance sheet and using their home as a means of doing so.
Mm.
That can't be a good long-term trend for the country.
Yeah. Well, it's an issue, yes.
Mm. We saw that the Red Book, and I think the Blue Book, has been released, so the briefing documents for incoming governments. One of the things the Treasury said very decidedly was that Australia needs to find a new competitiveness booster. It needs to increase productivity again. And for the first time that I've seen, they actually said reform of inefficient state taxes has got to be close to the top of the agenda.
Mm.
What's your view on that particular point?
Well, taxes are a specialty of the Treasury, and I'm happy to leave it to them. I've got no particular views on taxes.
Okay. In that case, I can't ask you this next question, which I'm about to advance to you, which is, what do you think of the Property Council's position that we should take inefficient taxes and replace them with efficient taxes? Surely, as an economist, you would agree with that proposition.
Well, I think everybody would agree with that. I mean, by the way it's been framed, it's a motherhood statement.
Yes. If only we could get every state treasurer. I'm sure there's at least one state treasurer who believes that that's a great idea. The double dip question.
Mm.
Is there any chance I could pin you down on a sort of a percentage? Given the next time the Reserve Bank Board meets will be on Melbourne Cup Day, so you might be in a betting frame of mind, or maybe the only handful of people that aren't in a betting frame of mind, I don't know. But what sort of percentage chance would you give to the US moving into a double dip?
Well, it's impossible to know, because the first thing to say is double dips are very rare. In fact, when I look through the data, I haven't been able to find a double dip apart from a double dip caused by a double cycle in monetary policy. You know, people talk about double dips as being a spontaneous sort of slowing in the economy, not affected by policy. And as far as I can tell, no such episode has ever existed.
After the Great Depression, 31, 32, there was reform, and then but in 37, 38, there was another, you know, quite bad downturn.
Yeah, but a lot of those were related to policy measures taking place at the same time. So, but look, they've had a very severe recession in the US, and the household finances are in very poor shape. So, and, you know, as I said, over the northern summer, the US economy definitely lost momentum. Mm. I think in recent weeks, the US data has been looking brighter again. And so I'm hopeful that the recovery continues.
Still a long-term pain, whereas America, you know, is usually a V. I mean, it just shoots out of those recessions. The bigger issue, of course, is China. Australia's heavily reliant on China. It's well known that the commodity cycle has suited us in terms of the growth of China. But also from an investment perspective, a lot of countries invest in Australia in a capital market sense because we're a proxy for China. Mm. It's harder for them to invest in Chinese currency, for instance. Well, there's two schools of thought here. There's the optimistic school and the pessimistic school in terms of China. Which one are you in?
Well, I wouldn't want to pin myself down on a time frame on that. I think in the long term, you've got to be optimistic about China. At their stage of development, there's going to be a lot more growth in China over the next 10, 20 years. Like every country, you know, they have their challenges in managing the economy. They, in the lead up to the financial crisis, growth was too strong. They tightened monetary policy and other policies quite significantly, and they were clearly looking to slow. And then they got caught up in the crisis, and growth slowed from 12% all the way down to 6%. That was clearly too slow for them. They had a very large fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus to try and offset that. That worked. If anything, worked too much, and they got growth back up to 12. And now they're in the process of pulling it back to the sort of range where my feeling is they're more comfortable, which is the 8 to 10% range. And I think they're broadly on track to do that. So for the moment, I think they're fine.
And so West
but
Australia...
But there will be cycles in China. I mean, China will have an economic cycle like every other country.
But over the short to medium term, then, states like Queensland and Western Australia, which have been great beneficiaries of the growth of China, you see that as being an important driver? You said before that, you know, these places aren't doing so well. When do they turn around? You know, when does Queensland turn around? When does it get its mojo back?
I think it's already starting. You know, there's nothing like income growth to fix previous problems. And income is growing across the country. And, you know, I think there were parts of the property industry up here, the residential property market, it was overdone. And a correction has to happen. But that's in the process of happening. And I think Queensland, you know, is basically through the worst of it. That'd be my guess.
Through the worst. That'll probably be the headline tomorrow. Mm. I'm going to ask you a question on the bulk of your speech was about finance and credit, which was... That was the only bit I disagreed with, the 80% on that. But who'd like to ask a question of the Deputy Governor first? Can we have a microphone? Yes. They're rushing towards the woman in red. If we could just get your name, please, and company.
Hi, I'm Angela Harper from Australian Associated Press. Dr. Badalino, with regard to your suggestion that it might be better for funding of the property sector to shift towards more equity and less debt, what policy measures do you think might be useful in achieving that shift? And secondly, with regard to your comment that it wouldn't be in anyone's interest to return to free-flowing credit, would the RBA take preventative measures if it looked like happening again? And if so, what action would it take, given that the bank didn't stop credit from becoming so free-flowing only a few years ago? Thank you.
Well, on the policy measures, I don't know if there are specific policy measures. I think these are really issues for individual company boards to deal with. And, you know, I think it has to be left to companies to make their own assessment of how much gearing they need to run their businesses. As to what measures the bank would take if lending was to pick up strongly again, well, I think we're a long way from that at the moment. I think the you know, credit demand is still very subdued, so I don't think that's anything we have to be concerned about in the near term. It's very difficult for central banks, you know, through a boom, to keep a really tight lid on credit because. You know, animal spirits get very strong through those periods. And in the short run, you know, higher interest rates don't necessarily impinge that much on people. So, you know, it is unrealistic to expect that we will ever be able to have a totally flat line on credit. There'll always be a cycle in credit. There's a cycle in equity markets. That's just the way things are. And people need to sort of, you know, take that into account in the way they run their businesses.
Next question.
I think that's just Matt Cranston from the Financial Review. Two questions. The Australian dollar. Do you think the advantages of a strong Australian dollar outweigh the disadvantages? And if so, why? And the other question is in relation to that statistic you gave on impairments in the property sector, the loan impairments. You said they'd risen from about half to 6%, and you said the retail and residential sectors were the worst affected. Can you just... Do you have a reason for why that would be?
Okay, well, on the impairment rates, you know, a lot of those things are company-specific as well, in the sense that you can have... If you have some very significant-sized companies in one sector... get into difficulties, that can really change the statistics. So I think it is very much a company-specific issue. On the Australian dollar, well, it's the... I'm not so sure whether the issue is whether the Australian dollar is strong or every other currency is weak, because at the moment, you know, a lot of countries in the world are following policies that either directly or indirectly are leading to weakness in their exchange rates. And that's a sort of a fact we have to take into account. There's very little we can do about that. It would be a big mistake for Australia to try and get involved in that process as well. I think we'd get ourselves into trouble very quickly. So I think we have to accept a period of strength in the exchange rate. I fully accept it's causing some difficulties in businesses. I think here in Queensland, in the tourist industry, it's been a major impact. But nonetheless, the economy is continuing to grow on average. The exchange rate in the past has always played a very important role in helping to equilibrate the economy, and I think it's doing that again on this occasion. But, as I say, it's helping the economy on average and not necessarily every sector.
Another question, please. Sir.
Russ Wood from Burnsbridge Suite. I'm not a journo, you'll be pleased to hear. But I did do a little bit of economics at uni, so just enough to be dangerous. One of the things that we work with clients in the capital spend space, and one of the things that we're seeing is that the blend between the fiscal and the monetary, we seem to be right at a critical time now for that, particularly with here in Queensland some of the building the education revolution spending slowing down, and we're hearing of some consultancies laying off staff as a result of nothing to go to after the stimulus. So I'd really love to try and prompt you into a stoush between the advantages and disadvantages of fiscal stimulus as opposed to the role that central banks play in terms of monetary policy providing stimulus to the economy, particularly in a situation where you say we seem to be bottoming out here in Queensland. But I think there's probably a bit of a hush around the crowd just at the moment in economic circumstances, given that post-BER and post-other stimulus spending, we're still not entirely sure where the economy's, local economy is going to go.
The Reserve Bank doesn't really have any role in fiscal policy, and I think there's not much point in me commenting on fiscal policy. There's no doubt the fiscal spending did contribute to spending through the downturn. Monetary policy did as well, but. I don't think I can say much more about fiscal policies, sorry.
I suppose another way of framing the question is that overseas at the moment there's a nervousness that some countries might be the Cameron government, that they're trying to reduce debt, whereas their European compatriots are saying, you know, maybe we should keep spending. And in the US, there's even talk of having a second stimulus. Another way of achieving the same result, of course, is to lower interest rates. They can't because they're already as low as they can go, but we could.
Yeah. In setting interest rates, we do take into account what's happening in the economy overall, and to the extent that fiscal policy is affecting the economy, it gets taken into account. I mean, that's just the way it is. The situation overseas is very different from here. Because of the, as you say, the difficulties some countries have, where they're up against the limit on monetary policy, but they're also up against the limit on fiscal tolerance as well. I mean, you know, people are very worried about the size of deficits and the size of debt. So that debate is raging overseas. I'm not sure what the answer is.
Sure. Another question? No other question. Stop. Is that what you're telling me? Oh, here we go.
Sorry, Kerry Sinclair from the Courier Mail. Sorry to take you back to the strong dollar, but can you say what implications a sustained strong dollar would have on interest rate decisions?
Okay. Sorry. Well, what is the impact of a strong dollar on interest rates?
The dollar is just one of the things that affects the economy, and through the impact it has on the economy, there will be an effect. On interest rates, because we will take all that into account. But there's no one-for-one trade-off between interest rates and the exchange rate is just something that, you know, it'll feed through the economy, and we'll take that into consideration when we set interest rates.
Yep. Final question. I was reading the Financial Review this morning, and John Hewson was in there. Dr. Hewson, who A, claims that he was the one who invented the inflation bands that were adopted by US central bankers. B, that the band is now wrong. And C, that the Reserve Bank is naive. He actually used those words this morning in his column. I presume you disagree.
I think so, yes. But I didn't read the AFR. What the argument was, presumably he wanted a lower inflation target?
Yeah, he wants more flexibility.
More flexibility. Ah, okay. Well, the you know, there's a limit as to how high you can let inflation go before it becomes an issue. It's quite a quite an appealing argument to say, well, if three's okay, well, surely 3.5's okay as well, or even 4. But, you know, the lessons that were learned through the late 60s and early 70s was that at some point you do have to draw the line, and the higher inflation has gone before you draw that line, the harder it is to get back to reasonable economic performance. So I think there's very little acceptance around the world, not just amongst central bankers, but also more generally in the in financial circles and government circles, for a greater tolerance of inflation, I think.
Do you think there's a case for having other targets? I mean, the inflation target has really proven itself to be an extraordinarily effective tool, despite what people might say about how it operates at the margin. But what about other targets? Like, and I'm not saying the Reserve Bank would set these or run these, but a target whereby governments actually of median house prices, for instance, and that if the median house price went outside a particular affordability band, on the back of some incredibly rigorous, transparent methodology, of course, then policy settings would change. I mean, the beauty about what you do is that you make a call and you explain why you do it, whereas with houses, you know, it's just up there in this bubble world of conflicting policies. A target. Drive policy through target for housing.
Mm. Well, it's appealing, but not very practical, I think. There's so many things affect housing which the Reserve Bank can't control, that I think that would be a mistake to go down that path.
It'd certainly be tricky. Final question. You did talk about finance for a while, and I think everybody in the room got your message, which was, well, you tell me if I get this wrong, party's over.
Mm.
Gearing levels were too high. There are cycles. This is the inevitable play out of that cycle. Yes, recognise that there is some people are doing it tough, but this day had to come. So we get that bit. You also said that, you know, maybe more equity and less debt might be appropriate. Maybe a counter argument to that is, look, last year we raised $21 billion. We, you know, recapitalised $21 billion. None of that $21 billion went into it. Just paid down debt. It didn't build another house. Mm. Didn't build another piece of productive infrastructure in Australia. That can't be a good use of money. But I suppose the real question is your thesis, is the inevitable conclusion one comes from your thesis that we don't need banking reform in Australia? Because our thesis would be we need more competition amongst banks, preferably more banks, not just necessarily foreign ones, a new CMBS market, probably government-backed like it is in Canada, that insurance companies and super funds would actually issue debt and thereby provide competition to the big four banks, as they do in the UK and other markets, and that we should have a more sophisticated corporate bond market as well, particularly on the listed side. So the question is, do you think that there is a case for those sorts of reforms that would end up with more competition in the Australian banking finance sector?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, competition and reform are all good things. But, you know, if you're saying that we need all these because we need more finance for property, I'm not sure I agree with that, because at the end of the day, I don't think there's any shortage of finance. If you look through the cycles in Australia, there's no shortage of finance. The system has been able to provide more than enough finance. The trouble is it comes in fits and starts. There are periods when you get too much, and then there's an inevitable period where there has to be a winding back. But on average, the system has provided plenty of finance.
Yep. He's a man who sticks with his opinions. Thank you for your frankness and for subjecting yourself to questions, which I know you don't have to do. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank our guest, Rick Battleman.
Thank you very much. Thank you.